This episode of Forensic Forecast is brought to you by Digital Forensics Magazine at www.digitalforensicsmagazine.com and by contributions by our listeners. Thank you all very much. Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. It's been a while since our last real episode, aside from the conversation I had with Rob Lee a little while ago. You haven't heard from us since January 13th. Now, just to put things in perspective a little, when we recorded the last episode, the SANS EU Forensic Summit was still on schedule. We were still relying on the SIFT Workstation 1.x. Americans could still get private healthcare. No one had heard of or cared about these stupid volcanoes in Iceland. I still worked at Zentec and lived in Wigan. David Beckham was still scheduled to be at the World Cup. Google and China were still getting along. And Team USA believed that they were still going to win the ice hockey gold at the Olympics. That one was especially for you, Joe. So the format of Forensic Forecast has changed a little bit. And I think we're going to stick with this way from now on because I think it's going to work pretty well. Is that rather than just having me and Simon talk to each other and have the occasional guest appear in an interview, we're going to do like a group panel thing. Because I love stuff like This Week in Tech, where Leo Laporte does that with all of his colleagues. So that's what we're going to do here as well. And having said that, we've got our first panel here ready to discuss all the latest digital forensic news. First of all, from Chicago, Illinois, we have Tom. How are you doing, Tom?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Next, we have Eric joining us from New Jersey. How are you doing, Eric?
Very good. Appreciate being on the show.
Oh, wonderful to have you. Thank you very much. And finally, last and not least, is Joe Garcia, who joins us today, and he does the Cybercrime 101 podcast. How are you doing, Joe?
Hey, what's going on, Lee? Thanks for having me on again.
So obviously we didn't scare you enough last time. You decided to come back.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well, it is good to have you on the show, even if you do try and insult me and try and steal Ken and all that kind of stuff.
But just so Ken knows, if this falls through, he still has a spot on Cybercrime 101.
Just hold on. No. Let's we're all friends here. Let's just calm down a bit. Okay. So let's move on with our first story. And I'm sure a lot of people have already seen this one. It's been doing the rounds a bit. And what it is, a judge has made a decision in a court case saying essentially that the private emails accessed via like webmail on company computers are no longer, a company can't go in and retrieve those emails lawfully as it person is due to privacy.
This is Eric, and I actually work for a Fortune 100 company running the digital forensics team for we do internal corporate investigations. So this actually is an area that we're familiar with, and we've been studying this fairly closely. To me, it's essentially attorney-client extremism. The court involved is the New Jersey Supreme Court, and what they've essentially said is attorney-client privilege trumps the company's property rights when it comes to their resources. In this particular case, they held that the people involved, the communication that was involved, which was privileged, that was used by a corporation, was improperly used because they've extended the reasonable expectation of privacy to the corporate assets through the attorney-client privilege. And it's sort of a law of unintended consequences here, because as a corporate investigator, let's say we have a tax attorney working in for a corporate entity, and that tax attorney can use the corporate resources. They have privileged communications. They're doing exactly what the company expects them to do with the corporate computer and the corporate network. Well, let's say that tax attorney decides to do some work on the side that they're not authorized to do by the company. And let's say they use the corporate time and resources and network to do that. Well, the communications that they are having for their side business are also going to be privileged. And it's going to be an interesting situation if something like that comes up. I don't know how I, as a corporate investigator, and obviously I'll have to work very closely with our legal counsel, are going to handle that, because all of the evidence, or most of the evidence, is going to be privileged. So time will tell, but since this is a New Jersey Supreme Court ruling, I'm not sure there's going to be much recourse and much chance of it changing unless the Supreme Court changes its mind.
Now, sorry, this is Tom. Now, Eric, I'm trying to remember because I haven't read about that article in a while. Were the privileged emails in question, wasn't that on like a personal Yahoo account, or was that on our corporate?
Yeah, it's a web-based. Exactly, it was a web-based account. And there's a lot of words in the ruling talking about personal password protected web-based email, and they're talking about monitoring if it's accessed through company equipment. Some of the speculation was, okay, well, gosh, you know, maybe if the warnings that companies give were more clear, you know, would that eliminate the reasonable expectation of privacy? And the court anticipated that and made it fairly clear in the ruling that, you know, it doesn't matter how you word it, that's still going to be an issue. So my question as a corporate investigator is like, well, that, to me, it seems like it's the court would rule not just the web-based email, but, you know, documents, Word documents, anything else that would be on the computer that is privileged would probably have that reasonable expectation of privacy. But we don't know, and that's why it's a bit of an unknown right now.
Now, the question is this court decision, does it just affect, say, the communications between a lawyer and their client, who in this case was this woman, or is this going to affect all private personal items that are accessed on a company computer? Because there's a bit of a differentiation to make there between the two. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I have to look at it some more and read it over again, but from my understanding, it seems like the court made a bright line rule that says, you know, attorney-client communications are, when they're sent or received, for the particular case, what they're saying is, look, attorney-client communications that are sent or received on, you know, the personal password-protected web-based email accounts are privileged. So in my scenario, if we have our attorney doing his side job on company time, that's going to fall under that. Now, the question would be is, okay, what if it's a Word document because, you know, it's an interrogatory for a case they're working? Would that also be considered covered under the reasonable expectation of privacy? That I don't know, but I suspect it probably would, but I'm not an attorney. You know, standard disclaimers apply, but it's something that we need to research more.
Well, and I think part of it is that, you know, I recall from a previous employer, this always sort of comes up with every company that, you know, well, we should put out a, you know, standard, you don't have a expectation of privacy and using a work machine, you know, we'll have you sign off these forms and so forth. But there's always been discussion that I've seen in a few different places that is it something that can be withheld or not withheld, but like court tested? Has it ever really been court tested in terms of, you know, though we have this person sign it, you know, and this sort of, as far as I know, becomes one of the first cases that really tests that. And that is there. Right. Is it something that, you know, you can withhold? I mean, especially when you start looking at, okay, You're talking about a web-based email, you know, Yahoo or Gmail, what have you, and that sort of is where it kind of gets kind of fuzzy because it's not technically something on somebody's computer per se because,
right,
you know, as we all know, from an examination perspective, most of that stuff is kept on the back end. Right. So is it – now when Eric was talking about doing the corporate attorney doing side jobs – I think you kind of classify that differently because you're, yes, it's attorney-client privilege in that sense, but it's essentially a side business because it's not one individual user. It's one attorney communicating with multiple clients. And I think hopefully the attorney would be wise enough to know not to do that, but I think you sort of end up classifying that separately than a individual that is communicating with his or her attorney over whatever.
And one of the analysis that I read as I got ready for the show today was from, and I won't identify it, from a law firm that published a PDF file that talked about the analysis. And one of the things that the law firm said is essentially, reading from it, it says, the court ruled that employers have no need to read the contents of personal privileged attorney-client communications. If that's actually what the New Jersey Supreme Court said, and if that's actually the Supreme Court's bright-line rule, then it would seem to be very broad. However, if it's just the attorney-client communications based on something indirect, as Joe describes, as a web-based email account where we know as forensic examiners that stuff, you know, can land on the machine, you know, maybe the court felt that, well, Jesus, not on their, on the machine, but I don't know, but it'd be something I'm very interested in talking to somebody who would be knowledgeable on this sort of thing.
If I could jump in for a second, I wonder how this is going to spread out into not only attorney-client privilege, but how it's going to spider out into just general email communications from, you know, from, you know, from a business machine, and how that would affect, let's just say, like an insider case, like an insider threat type case, where somebody's taking out company secrets and emailing them off, you know,
right.
Where, you know, this is so, you know, ambiguous that, you know, down the road, it could get challenged again, you know, and it could be, and language could be set forth later on. There should be something a little bit clearer established than just this, you know?
Well, I think this is going to be something that's going to be kind of hard to silo, because you have in this case, the attorney-client privilege. And then let's say in another case, you know, how many companies have we worked at, such as Joe, obviously, that, or even maybe with Joe, that, you know, people forward stuff to their home so that they can work on it at home, and they use their Gmail or Yahoo account to do it. You know, and now you have company stuff going through a essentially non-controlled company, or not controlled by the company, network.
So what do the companies do then? Do they just do like blanket policies saying that, you know, no access to private stuff? Or do they say, well, yeah, we're going to allow it, but we're going to gamble on taking the risk a little bit here? Because you're going to have a lot of people feeling very uncomfortable with very, very strict policies, aren't you?
It's got to be, I guess, an extreme. You know, you have to go to the extreme if you're a company that wants to protect their assets. You're going to just have to shut everything down. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, there are a lot of employees who are allowed to work from home. You know, I guess the company's going to have to rethink their business strategy and how they're going to allow that. But, you know, you're going to have to shut everything down. No personal emails, you know. I don't know how that's going to be possible nowadays, but.
Well, I think what will happen is you'll have the policy that'll start being extremely specific in terms of, you know, you have no expectation of privacy, including the following. And right. It'll start listing it out as these court cases roll out. And it's, in the end, it's going to be about the company managing risk. How much risk are they willing to take with their employees to balance out, you know, what they should or shouldn't be doing with their computers that are company assets?
Right.
I just wonder if the companies run the risk a little bit here, though, because, you know, on one hand, you got the, you know, you lock it down so tight that the people can't really do what they need to do in order to function in their job role. On the other side, you know, you may give too much freedom to people. It's difficult to find common ground.
Well, it's the stuff you see already. You know, you do it, you lock them down so much they can't do their job, and then the other extreme is you don't lock them down enough, and they're either spending their day on Facebook, or, you know, they're surfing BitTorrent sites, or their machines are opened up to peer-to-peer networks.
Now, speaking of peer-to-peer software, I'm glad you brought it up, because it brings us to our next story, which is that the RIA and the MPAA want government-mandated spyware installed on everyone's computer that deletes infringing content automatically. They've just done, basically, I don't know, this is crazy stuff, really. They want to install this stuff on everyone's computer that will search for copyrighted material and say, oh, here we go, let's delete it. Wonderful idea.
The first rule of holes is when you're in one, stop digging. And the second rule of holes is remember the first rule of Vols. And RIAA has been just digging for years. You know, suing your customers apparently didn't work, so spying on them apparently is the new business model. And I just don't see how it's going to work, but they just keep going at it, and I just don't know what... I know what they're thinking, but it seems like they're desperately trying not to modify the business model to meet the realities of communication technology, and are instead just kind of going around this dystopian future of monitoring their customers.
I mean, how many court cases have they actually won, if any? I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
Well, there was the Jamie Thomas one.
Right, yeah, that one, I think.
Yeah, there's been a – I think they've won maybe about five, but they don't really – a lot of the ones, most of them they said have just settled. So there hasn't been a lot that they've gone to court, which is why a lot of the ones you hear about are big deals, because a lot of people are like, you know, let's take them to court and see if they – right, and let's just see if they can actually do it.
So this article – it's from Gizmodo, so it might be slightly biased. It talks about five things that the RIA and the MPAA are calling for. First is that they want spyware on your computer that detects and deletes infringing material. Mandatory sensorware on all internet connections to interdict transfers of infringing material. Border searches of personal media players, laptops and thumb drives. International bullying to force other countries to implement the same policies, and free copyright enforcement provided by federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security.
What makes me laugh is that movies are still breaking box office records, but yet they still seem to think that they're losing money. I don't get it. You know, and even top artists, you know, that CDs are still selling hand over fist. But yet they think it's still good to sue their customers. I don't understand it.
Well, and I think they've gotten themselves in a position now where they don't really have much of a choice. You know, they started down this path, and it's almost like, you know, how do you stop the landslide?
Right. It's almost like they don't want to admit failure. It's like, well, we can't back off now, so let's just keep pushing forward.
Right. And it's almost, you know, it's like a lot of the companies, for example, just in comparison, that are, you know, sue for patent infringement and stuff, where everyone thinks it's kind of a ticky-tack type thing, but it's like, yeah, but they need to show long-term that they've enforced this, otherwise...
Yeah, they have to defend their brand.
Right.
Otherwise they lose their digital their identity, essentially.
What I always kind of wonder about these sorts of things in this sort of extreme is and maybe it's just me, but it always seems like it's very U.S. focused, that, you know, it's like the comprehension isn't there that where do you draw the line? How do you determine a quote unquote U.S. person versus someone in another country? And how do you, you know, like if I go overseas and you have this software on my machine, does that mean you can't use it anymore or what?
So the question I have is this. What, you know, let's say that the government approves this and they say, yeah, you know, we'll take these steps and we'll install this this spyware on these people's machines. How on earth do they manage this? Because you got to think of all the different new computers being sold, people building their own computers, you know, the operating systems and all the different platforms involved. This is going to be a complete logistical nightmare. It's just not practical to do, is it?
I want to know who's going to do the tech support.
That's exactly it. Now you're responsible. And they had, you know, one of the own goals they scored was that, remember that the Sony rootkit thing? You know, that went over terribly. So, you know, are they asking to do that, you know, on a large scale? And what happens, you know, when my computer doesn't work because they're digital rights management or spyware or whatever it would they would create it as causes problems with the machine.
And one of the other things too is and someone correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought there was a clause in the DMCA that that from a fair use perspective, I could take my media, be it DVD or CD, and make a personal copy of it, backup or whatever. As long as it's not distributed, that's still considered fair use. Or did they get rid of that?
Yeah, I think that the DMCA allows you to take backups of stuff which you don't have to break any kind of encryption scheme to get in. Like, so for DVDs, you got things are encrypted there. If it's not an encrypted DVD, then fair enough, you can take copies for it. But you know, that's fair enough. I mean, but over in the States, for example, you're allowed to do that. Over here, taking any copies of anything is just no, don't do it. Just not allowed. So how are they going to differentiate between, like, the different countries? If people buy a computer in one country and go to a different country, if people go on vacation or on business, how do they differentiate between all those?
Well, hey, let's take it to a different extreme. Let's say I'm over in the UK and I buy a CD over there of a band that you can't get in the US, and then I come back home and rip it here. You know, I own a legitimate copy that I want to put on my iPod. So what are you going to do in that scenario?
I do find it quite interesting, a couple of these little points here, the 5 points I had before. For example, the border searches of personal media players, laptops and thumb drives, and free copyright enforcement provided by federal agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security. Now, what I don't understand, I mean, first of all, how many computers and all these devices travel across the United States and other countries' borders on a daily basis? There must be millions of them. And, you know, do they really expect the government to be, you know, their revenue protectors here? Because it just, why should they get such preferential treatment in this case?
I don't know, but don't they have a problem with terrorists getting into the United States that now they're worried about infringing copyrighted material? I mean, come on.
I heard a rumor there was a problem about that.
Yeah, maybe I'm just a little skewed because I'm in New York. I don't know. I don't think I really want them worried about something that somebody got off the Pirate Bay. You know, Jesus. I mean, yeah, come on,
I'd
guys.
Rather they look for the guy with the fuse in his shoes rather than the guy who ripped a Ramon CD.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, wasn't there a story a while back that, like, piracy, like, fueled the terrorism or something like that? I thought that angle was, like, picked up.
But wait, if I'm not paying for it, how did I fuel terrorism? I don't get it. Anyway, that's random thought. You know what? Maybe if they change their practices, they'd make more money. Like for instance, you look at like an instance of Nine Inch Nails, right? Trent Reznor basically had to go out and, you know, him and who was the other band? I was thinking Coldplay for a second. Jeez. Anyway, there was another band. They went out and basically they produced their own stuff and they put it out and they made a ton of money off it. The problem is that, you know, what they're looking to do is they just look to rip people off. They charge an extraordinary amount of money and, you know, where does it go? You know, the artists don't get it. So, I don't know.
Well, even their legal models, the iTunes, which, you know, I use, is I don't buy as much content from iTunes as far as music because it's expensive. It's been a while since I've bought anything. I know at one point it was 99 cents. Now it's even more. So they're trying to charge those of us who you know, are buying it legitimately, or at least within their current business model, more to subsidize, you know, their inability to modify their business model.
One thing I do find particularly interesting is that who are they actually punishing here with all of this? You know, because the hackers and the crackers, they'll find a way to get past all this spyware crap. But, you know, the honest people who buy their music, they're going to be lumped with this stuff on their computers. How fair is that?
Right. It's the same debate in with computer games, you know, one of my vices, because I am that much of a geek. Digital rights management is always sort of chafed on gamers because you spend a lot of money, you know, sometimes $50 or $60 to buy a game, and then sometimes it will cause problems with your PC because of the copyright protection. You know, meanwhile, you can get it off a torrent for free, and you know, it's not an issue. So those of us who are buying the games legitimately, we're having problems because of the copyright protection.
Yeah, weren't there issues with Spore when EA released that? Like, you were only allowed to put it, like, install it once, and then, like, God forbid, your computer crapped out on you and you had to reinstall it again.
Yeah, exactly.
The DRM
yeah,
would let you reinstall it.
Exactly. In the game industry, to their credit, one of the things that they've done is they've really embraced the digital distribution of their content. I buy almost all of my games now through Valve Steam, and yeah, there's DRM, but I've never had any problems with it. And I don't have to have the media, because one of the things that really chafed for me is anytime I wanted to play a game, I had to have the CD and the computer, and I'd just rather not keep a bunch of CDs around. So now I just go and grab things digitally. I do the same thing with books now. I recently bought a Kindle, which I've come to adore, and I just have the content digitally, and I buy, I bought a fistful of books the other day for less than $10 a pop for, a lot of content. So that's a business model as a consumer I'm willing to embrace. So I think RIAA needs to relax and maybe take some, learn from some of the other media content providers what they're doing.
Okay, cool. Thanks, guys. Okay, so the next story we're going to talk about is, you may remember a couple months back in Philadelphia, some school district managed to allegedly inadvertently take a bunch of pictures of a student sitting in his own bedroom, and as it turns out, in the last couple of days, it turns out that there's been not just a few pictures being taken, but they think there could be thousands of pictures involved in this case. Now, I'm just stunned by this, but, are these people completely out of their minds?
Yes.
Yes. Next topic.
And I'm embarrassed to say I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and I read this, and I was just like, oh, my God. I think it's even in around my neck of the woods where I was born and raised, and it's one of those things. That's, I think the intentions were good, because wasn't it supposed to be like if the machine got stolen or something like that, they'd be able to track it?
Yes.
But it's like, it, you know, who's watching the watchers? So, well, it's probably a bad pun in this case, but it's one of those things that it has good intentions for the school in terms of, reclaiming something that could potentially be lost, but all you need is just somebody bored sitting on the other end going, oh, well, let's see what this does.
Now, I forget how this came about in the first place. I think that this kid, he was taken in by the principal or something like that, who was asking him, saying stuff like, you shouldn't be doing stuff like this at home with one of our computers or something like that.
He was doing something at home that was against school policy or something like that. I think that's what it was. And then didn't they suspend him or something like that?
I think they may have done, except for the fact that he tried to bring action against him through his parents.
Apparently they accused him of selling drugs and taking pills, and it's just from the stories I've read, and they reportedly in the media, they used some sort of snapshot taken by the computer as evidence of that. And then the student in turn said, well, no, that's just showing me eating candy. Now, I don't know what's, I'm a former police officer, so I don't believe anything anymore. But that, I think, was the precipitating event that set everything off, where I think after that questions were raised, and then the kind of the cloak of the program was removed and people understood what was going on, and that's, I think, pretty shortly afterward hit the media. You're asking for, legions of angry parents. I mean, if, being a father of a daughter, if I found out the school was taking pictures of my daughter, partially undressed and sleeping, which is one of the articles I'm reading, I can guarantee you I'm going to take a can of spray paint, draw a pentagram on the floor, chant, I summon thee, and I'm going to hire whatever appears as my lawyer and say, go to work. And I will not stop until, I get satisfaction. So imagine this writ large, again, with all sorts of families. I'm sure there are plenty of angry parents who are doing the same thing.
Well, and here's another aspect that's kind of a sidetrack of what you brought up. Now, let's say they're doing that, and this was high school students, right?
Yeah.
You start turning on cameras for people that are underage,
contraband.
And you start hitting a contraband thing, and now you're broadcasting almost child porn across whatever system that they're using to do this.
Promotion, possession. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one article that I'm looking at now says that they have, one sophomore they took over 400 images of, and that the cameras were set to capture pictures every 15 seconds. So let me see, what is it? Works out to be like almost 26, 27 minutes that they were taking pictures of this kid. I mean, I don't know. What's the excuse at that point if it wasn't reported stolen?
Well, and the other aspect too is that what, you know, who should be doing that? Is that a law enforcement thing or is that a school district thing? Because you're basically doing surveillance.
Right.
And, yeah, you know, then it's like the getting into wiretapping and stuff like that.
Exactly. And Joe, I'd be curious on your take on this. You're a, you know, an active police officer. If this is the government doing this, is this something that would have constituted an illegal search? I mean, if it were a private school, it's like, well, all right, who knows what criminal laws were involved, but, you know, to actually search someone's home for the government, not just the police, I would think that, the rules of criminal procedure would still apply to a government school just as much as it would provide to a government police officer.
Yeah, I mean, where I've dealt with this on a law enforcement level has been mostly when complainants, computers are stolen and they have something like Absolute Software installed, which is the same type of software basically. And they call up Absolute Software and they report their laptop stolen. And then Absolute would go out and see where the laptop is pinging the net from, and they could activate the camera and take pictures. But that, you know, it's kind of like you know, they're doing like an initial investigation. Then once they get enough, then they pass it off. They contact whichever local law enforcement it is, and they pass it off. I never had to deal with a school where a school has done this, so I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure how that's supposed to work. You know, I mean, obviously they're not supposed to be turning on to begin with, but I would, you know, this would essentially be a search warrant. I mean, because I would assume it would be a search warrant. If you, like, let's just say you think that something was going on illegally with that laptop, that whatever, they were using it to traffic drugs or guns or something like that, even though they're students, you'd probably have to go notify law enforcement and then let them get a search warrant. It's almost like having to read somebody's emails. You know, like in order for law enforcement to get real-time email transactions, they would need to apply for a search warrant, a Title III search warrant here in the U.S. And, you know, that this just, you know, they just dropped the ball all around on this. There's no excuse for this whatsoever. You can't even make something up that would cover this on their end.
It makes me wonder if there's a case for, like, that the school has ultimate responsibility for what these computers are used for. I mean, they pay for the computers, they give them to the students, and so somewhere along the line, if they use the computers for something like sexting or, you know, emailing pictures of each other naked or whatever else, then, you know, I can kind of see a little bit about where they're coming from. So I feel like I can see a little bit of both sides here.
Can't even see the other side of it. There is no other side.
I mean, if the point is kind of determining that if the machine's been stolen and recovering the machine, that's one thing. And then the system shouldn't be turned on until then, period. But if it's – and that should be clearly stated that that's all that system's for.
Yeah, I mean, I understand they want to protect their property, but there is no excuse for that. The only reason for that software is to recover lost or stolen property, not to just survey kids. You're not supposed to do that. You know, I mean, it's – Big Brother on a smaller scale.
Now, I want to make it absolutely clear, I don't agree with what they did by any stretch of the imagination. All I'm saying is that, you know, if they have used the computers to do something potentially illegal, they're culpable at some point because, you know, they're the ones who put the computers into the hands of the student to start with.
You know what? Let law enforcement deal with it then. If that's what you think is going on with you're the school, you think that's going on with your property, you know what? Notify law enforcement. But there's really nothing that law enforcement can do because unless you're basically infringing on these kids' rights, their freedoms, you're not going to know. And if you did, then you're looking at getting arrested. You know, so it's... That's the beauty of this country is you have all these freedoms, and, you know, unfortunately the school wouldn't even have a leg to stand on at that point.
Does anyone know, was this a service that they added, or was it just something similar to like LoJack for laptops or something like that that they were using, Or was it like a service that the school purchased from somebody?
I think it's called LANREV or something like that.
Yeah, that's a software I've seen referenced in the article. I don't know the capabilities of that or what the purpose of that is.
But it wasn't like a managed service, so to speak, that they bought. They still controlled it, so to speak. They put it on the machines and then gave it to the student.
You know, basically, their IT guys are, you know, they should be getting arrested, you know, at this point.
Well, one of them's trying to plead the fifth, is from what I'm seeing in the articles. So obviously they have an attorney who understands that there's a pretty serious problem confronting their client.
Okay, so moving on to our next story. So at the beginning of this month, here in the UK, the Coroners and Justice Act 2009, because it was a bill in 2009 and just recently passed, came into effect. And while, you know, the Coroners and Justice Act might not sound like anything particularly interesting or special, there is a segment in there which talks specifically about images of child abuse and decent pictures of children and the like. And this is quite controversial because this little segment now means that anything which is effectively like a cartoon image or a 3D rendered image that looks like an indecent picture of a child, that is now punishable under the law to the same extent as are like your everyday indecent pictures of a child, which I find to be quite incredible, really. I wrote an article about this originally on Forensic Forecast, and I had to take it down because it was slightly too controversial. I know some of you find it hard to believe, but I just like to gauge what you guys' thoughts are on this, because to me it's quite astounding.
Cricket.
Is there like guidelines in terms of how they're going to determine the age of a cartoon character? I mean, aside from the obvious, like The Simpsons, you know, you can get a pretty good idea.
Don't they leave
but...
it up to the judge?
I think it would usually come down to the jury instead, wouldn't it?
Okay. You know, I read the you sent the article out and I looked at it. My initial response was, you know, geez, they're burning down the kitchen to get rid of the ants. And then I did some more research, and with the Ministry of Justice, and I'll admit up front, I'm not as aware of the UK laws dealing with contraband. The Ministry of Justice basically says, look, their concern is they really want to clamp down on kind of the hardcore pedophilia content in cartoon format that you can get out of places like Japan. So, you know, going back to being a father of a daughter, I'm sympathetic towards that. What I've read, the concern is they may have cast such a broad net that you could have comics such as The Watchmen, which is a classic graphic novel, falling under that net, because we're all geeks here and we have all read it, admit it. I certainly have. There's a panel where Rorschach sees his mother engaging in prostitution, and I think the part of the law would cover, you know, depictions of minors exposed to sexual content, and that would cover something like that. So it's kind of a classic debate as far as how do you craft a law to target really nasty behavior and clamp down on the market and still preserve legitimate artistic expression. And as I read this back and forth, and I think, I don't know how much contraband cases Tom does, but I know you and Joe do that. My question is this a solution in search of the problem, in that if you have a pedophile who is, you know, I know that they're very keen on their collections, how many of them would just engage in, you know, the really evil cartoon format to the exclusion of the photographic format? And what I'm curious is, if you do a search warrant, I would think most of the time you're going to find both. I can't imagine a hardcore pedophile is going to restrict themselves just to the cartoon format. How often are you finding collections where it's just cartoons because you have a particularly legally savvy pedophile who knows that they can do the cartoon content, let's say from Japan or someplace like that, and not do the photographs. I would find it hard to believe if someone with a compulsion for that sort of content would restrict themselves just to drawings.
I mean, I could say I've never come across it where they've had a collection that was solely cartoon/comic-based. I haven't come across it at all.
No, me either.
I mean, I could probably even say with certainty that if I've seen them sprinkled in here and there, that's a lot. And sprinkled, I mean like a few, like a handful. Usually it's not. I mean, I personally haven't come across it where it's just like hundreds and hundreds of these types of images. Yeah, most of it's all, you know, live, you know, not live victims, but, you know, whether they be sets of images that have been around since the 60s and 70s up until, you know, more recent time. I've never really come across a collection like that. I don't know about Lee, but I haven't.
No, I've never seen any time, any case where they've just had the pictures, like the cartoon pictures on there. There's always been like the real pictures of abuse. Like you say, Joe, with like the smattering of these cartoon pictures. I don't really get it, to be honest.
I mean, I can understand if somebody had a whole collection of that, I think it's called hentai in Japan. I mean, it's mixed where it's, you know, adults and, you know, underage looking depictions of kids. I can understand that if it's like the underage depiction of kids in that type of, you know, the Japanese hentai. But like, all right, where does it stand if you got an image of Cartman or Bart Simpson or something? You know, where, you know, Bart Simpson bears his ass. You know what I mean? Is that really child pornography? No, you know.
Well, for example, have you guys seen the Simpsons movie?
No, I haven't.
No, well, there's scenes in that where you see Bart skateboarding along and you see, like, his genitalia and stuff like that. You have to wonder, why is that allowed? And yet, you know, stuff.
Well, wasn't there another episode where he was, like, completely nude and Homer didn't pick him up or something like that?
But it just boggles the mind because I don't understand why something can be perfectly legitimate for people to go and watch on a cinema screen, and yet to have that sitting on your computer at home can all of a sudden become illegal.
Yeah, I think, like we said before, it just, you're casting out a wide net, you know, when it should be a little more specified. It should be a much more specified situation, you know. Like I said, Cartman, I mean, you know, do I really want to lock somebody up because they had, you know, pictures of Cartman in the buff? No, not really, you know, but
I guess the thing that worries me the most about this is that, like you said, this is a blanket approach to something, and here we have, you know, potentially we could have like a young solicitor or a young cop who's like, oh, wow, someone's got this stuff on their computer. They might not have anything else on there, but because the law is there, they can then say, right, let's attack this person. We're going to throw the book at them. And I think it gets a little bit unfair at that point.
Well, in some of the articles I've read, what the government basically said, I'm paraphrasing, of course, saying, look, trust us, we'll use this appropriately. Well, I don't think that's a good idea because, you know, the current UK government may be angels with the wisdom of Old Testament prophets, but another one in the future may not be. So I think giving government that much of a tool probably isn't a great idea, and it should be narrowed. Like I said, I'm certainly sympathetic towards defining as contraband things that are clearly contraband, even if they're just drawings. I know some people disagree with that, but this, I think as it's written, is a little bit too broad.
Okay, thanks for your input on that, guys. Really, really appreciate it. Right, well, I'm out of news stories. Is there anything that you guys would particularly like to add?
Yeah, I'll throw something in. Tomorrow is the New York Computer Forensic Show. It's going to be located at the 7 West New York Convention Center in New York, in Manhattan. I'm trying to remember. Hold on one second. Let me just see. The conference hours are tomorrow, which is April 19th. Actually, you're not even going to have this on air tomorrow, so what's the point? Cut that out, Lee. I was just thinking about that. You're probably not going to have it. It's going to be waiting.
For our historical segment, there was a computer conference.
There was a computer
Just talk
conference.
About how great it was.
It was awesome. Even though I'm not going to be there, I'm going to be in training tomorrow, but it was awesome. All right, so scratch that. I wasn't thinking ahead.
Actually, I have one. I was looking through my RSS feed earlier today, and this is kind of a funny one that I didn't hear about initially. It was on Dark Reading for there was a security breach at Countrywide Home Loans where an employee took about 20,000 customer records. I'm sorry, 20,000 customer records a week for more than 2 years and sold them to a third party. What was interesting about this was apparently the policy that the company had, and I'm kind of glancing over the article again, was that they were super gluing the USB ports on their computers and apparently missed one. And that's how their USB blocking policy was that they super glued the ports, which I had never heard of anyone ever doing before. But one part of the article says it's apparently been done before. I've never heard of it, and it seems kind of extreme. And I kind of wonder what you do when you run out of, you know, the PS2 keyboards and mice that are out in the market.
So say times like 100 for good measure, yeah. So, yeah. See, that's selling over 2 million customer records to.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
I hope this guy was making serious bank off this because he's gonna need it in order to.
Yeah, they're gonna lock him up until mammals are extinct.
Oh yeah, dude, that is not cool. Well, I hope none of you guys have done business with that company lately.
No.
Well, you know what? It's funny. It always seems to be the loan companies nowadays. They're either going out of business or people are finding hard drives with their data on them.
Oh, all fun stuff. Yeah, when I was in the process of moving, I was taking stuff to and from the what we call the rubbish tip here. You guys would call the dump or something. And the electronics compartment where you go and put all your TVs and everything else just full of like old computers, and I just thought, you know, how easy would it be to walk in there, grab a few of the drives out of those, go home and, you know, have at it and just see exactly what information these people left on their computers without properly disposing of them. I just think it would be quite an interesting little experiment to try.
Oh, it's like people buying the drives off of Amazon, or not Amazon, eBay. And then, you know, how many, I think it may have been on one of your podcasts you guys were talking about, you know, the percentage of data that people were finding on these drives.
Yeah. I just think it's quite funny because, like, obviously people throw out computers because they're defective. Now, depending on which part of the computer is defective, that they obviously... the average person isn't going to take the isn't going to have the sense really to say, right, well, we've got to destroy whatever information's on here. And I might even try it. I might go to the local rubbish tip and extract a few hard drives and see what's on them, just for a bit of fun.
Well, it just amazes me anymore because it's like so easy in most cases. Now, laptops, of course, are an exception, to pull those hard drives out and just, you know, hold on to them and do something with them later and then get rid of the machines.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're going to throw in the dump anyway, what's the difference?
I think I've got a 15 gig quantum fireball sitting upstairs on my desk that I just refuse to let go of. Came out of a machine from like back in 1995 or something ridiculous like that. So I just don't ever throw anything out unless it's clicking badly enough, and then I give it a good smack with a hammer before chucking it out. But now I'm working for the company which could actually get the data back from that anyway. So, but yeah, good stuff. All right. Well, all right. Well, if Speaking of smashed hard drives, actually, something just occurred to me. Scott Moulton, who's been on the show previously, he will be on Revision 3's Techzilla on April 26th, which I think that's next Monday. So look out for that. It should be a lot of fun. He's going to be on there talking to Patrick Norton. So it'll be well worth a little look.
Yeah, I've seen Scott twice at the last two ShmooCons, and his talks are great, man. If you have a chance to catch it or to listen to it at a later time, definitely take the time out and check it out. Definitely worthwhile. Wealth of information about hard drives.
Yeah. So keep an eye out for that. It's it'll also be available as a podcast or to view again later on. So keep an eye out. All right, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this evening, or this afternoon, or this morning, wherever you may be. it's been fun, and I think it's actually worked.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it, Lee. I appreciate the invitation very much.
Yeah, me too. I will be more than happy to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Lee.
All right. Well, in the meantime, do you want to share where people can find you, like on Twitter and stuff like that?
Yeah,
Joe might as well go first. He's going to take the longest.
Who, me?
Yeah, Joe, yeah, go ahead.
Wow. No, why, I'm going to take the longest. Why? All right.
How many Twitter accounts do you have?
I have two. That's it.
Oh, okay.
I only have one more than everybody else. Well, actually, no. I have the same amount as you, Mr. Lee. Anyway, I'm the host of the Cybercrime 101 podcast. You can catch me on Twitter at Cybercrime101. Or if you're one of the computer forensics or InfoSec peeps out there and you want to add somebody else to your follow list, if you could add me, I'm at jgarcia62. If you could please check out my website, cybercrime101.com, and check out the show. You can listen to the show directly on the website, or you can check it out on iTunes just by searching Cybercrime 101. And I guess, Tom, you'll go next.
I'm easy. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at CDTDelta.
Cool. And Eric?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Eric J. Huber, H-U-B-E-R. It's all one word. And then I've recently started up my blog, which I call A Fistful of Dongles. You can find that at ericjhuber.blogspot.com. And Joe was nice enough to put a link to the blog, which I appreciate very much, also on his website. And, of course, reciprocated.
Yeah, no, Fistful of Dongles.
Yeah, no, I mean,
you Clint Eastwood reference, had to do it.
Yeah, no, but you had some interesting stuff there on the Kindle, and it's the forensic artifacts of value that would, you know, might come up for an investigator. So,
yeah, I'm a horrible forensic geek. If I could have imaged my dishwasher, I would probably have did it. So, of course, the first thing that happens when I get a Kindle is I want to know what I can pull out.
But it was definitely good information, you know, should check it out if you're a forensics peep like us here. Definitely some interesting, you know, like Eric mentioned on a second post, which is you don't want to wait until you have one of these sitting on your property shelf, you know, before you kind of figure out what's available on it. So it's definitely a worthwhile read.
That's my argument for getting an iPad.
Exactly.
If anyone's feeling kind enough to send me one, that'd be much appreciated. But anyway, yeah, Eric is also speaking at CEIC. When is that?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That's in May. I forget the date. It's later in May. I'm doing a research project with Christian Gudjonsson of logthetimeline.net, and he's the brains behind the project, basically the brawn. But I'm going to be doing a presentation on Adobe Flash cookies, which is what we're working on. I'll be doing that at CEIC. And then we're working on an article that we're going to release that will cover a lot of the data that we won't have the ability to do, or I won't have the ability to do at the CEIC conference. So I'd be happy to meet the listeners and talk to them there.
And that will be May 24th through the 27th in Nevada.
Thank you.
See, Tom should know. So, all right. As for me, you can find me at Schizofroid, at Forecast, and I'll go one better than Joe, because I've also got another podcast, which is Abort, which is AB0RT. So at Abort, you can find me at as well. Also, just to just to clarify something, the SANS EU Forensic Summit has been postponed from the 19th and 20th of April until sometime around August, September. Now, I was due to do a presentation about volume shadow copies on Tuesday. Unfortunately, that's not going to be happening anymore, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to find something else to present at the summit, and I'm going to put that presentation up for everyone to see on the Forensic Forecast website, and there'll also be a paper released simultaneously with that as well. So have at it, have a look. If you disagree with anything I say, tell me about it. If there's anything you want to add to it, let me know. Be glad to hear it. I just hope it's useful to someone. So once again, thank you very much, Tom, Joe, and Eric. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and we'll have to do it again.
Thank you.
Cool, thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Lee.
All right, take care, guys.